This is a summary of dollars and cents by bestbookbriefings.com. How We Misthink Money and How to Spend Smarter, author Dan Ariely and Jeff Chrysler. The Money Volcano. In 1975, Bob Eubanks hosted a short-lived TV game show called The Diamond Game Hunter. Taped in Hawaii, it featured a unique bonus round called The Money Volcano. Contestants were put in a glass box that quickly transformed into a furious wind tunnel of flying money. Bills whirled, spun, and flapped all around as the players scrambled to grab as much as they possibly could before time ran out. They went absolutely bonkers inside the money volcano, reaching, clutching, spinning, and flailing inside a tornado of cash. It was great entertainment. For 15 seconds, it was clear that nothing in the world was more important than money. To a certain extent, we are all inside the money volcano. We are playing the game in a less intense and visible manner, but we have been playing, and being played, for many years, in countless ways. Most of us think about money a lot of the time, how much we have, how much we need, how to get more, how to keep what we have, and how much our neighbors, friends, and colleagues make, spend, and save. Thinking about money would be fine if by thinking more about it, we were able to make better decisions. But that's not the case. The truth is, making bad money decisions is a hallmark of humanity. We're all fantastic at messing up our financial decisions. Consider this example. Does it matter if we use credit cards or cash? We spend the same amount either way, right? Actually, studies show we are more willing to pay more when we use credit card. Let's explore some of the most common mistakes we make when it comes to money. And more importantly, why we make these mistakes. Then, when we face our next financial decision, we might be better able to understand the forces at play and, hopefully, make better choices or at least more informed ones. What is money? Money itself has no value. It only represents the value of the things we can get with it. It's a messenger of worth. There are special features of money that make it useful. It is general. We can exchange it with almost everything. It is divisible. It can be applied to almost any item of any size, no matter how large or small. It is fungible. We don't need a specific piece of currency because it can be replaced by any other piece representing the same amount. Any $10 bill is as good as any other $10 bill, no matter where and how we get it. It is storable. It can be used at any time, now or in the future. Money doesn't age or rot, unlike cars, furniture, organic produce, or college t-shirts. While it is important to recognize how important and useful money is, we have to realize that some of its benefits are also the source of its curses. Opportunity cost. Even though we can do almost anything with money, doesn't mean we can do everything with it. We must make sacrifices by choosing what not to do. That means we absolutely must, consciously or not, consider opportunity costs every time we use money. Opportunity costs are alternatives. They are the things we give away, now or later, in order to do something. These are the opportunities that we sacrifice when we make a choice. Obviously, when we spend money on one thing, we cannot spend the same money on something else. A bigger picture, opportunity costs are not restricted to the realm of personal finance. They have global ramifications, as President Dwight Eisenhower noted in a 1953 speech about the arms race. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. A value proposition. Here are a few ways in which humans have valued things incorrectly. The cost to rent an apartment in some major cities can climb to more than $4,000 per month, and we don't seem to blink. The price of gas rises 15 cents, and it can swing a national election. Startup tech companies with no revenue are regularly valued to be worth hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars, and we act surprised when they don't live up to these expectations. Some people go on a $10,000 vacation but spend 20 minutes each day looking for free parking. We have always assessed value in ways that are not necessarily connected to value at all. We forget that everything is relative. In 2012, Ron Johnson, the new CEO of GSpenny, did scrap Penny's traditional and slightly deceptive practice of marking products up and then marking them back down. In the decades before Johnson's arrival, GSpenny always offered customers coupons, deals, and in-store discounts. These reduced Penny's regular prices, which were artificially inflated, to appear to be bargain deals. But in fact, after the discounts, their prices were in line with prices everywhere else. In order to get to the final retail price of an item, customers and the store would perform this kabuki theater of raising prices at first and then lowering them in all kinds of creative ways with different signs, percentages, sales, and discounts. And they played the game over and over again. Then, Ron Johnson made the store's prices fair and square. No more coupon cutting, bargain hunting, and sale gimmick. Just the real price, roughly equal to those of its rivals and roughly equal to their previous final prices after raising and discounting them. Ron Johnson's G. Spinney offered products at more honest prices and was rejected in favor of sales gimmicks. Think about that. G. Spinney's customers voted with their wallets and they elected to be manipulated. They wanted deals, bargains, and sales, even if it meant bringing back inflated regular prices, which is exactly what G. Spinney eventually did. G. Spinney and Ron Johnson paid a high price for failing to understand the psychology of pricing, but the company ultimately learned that it could build a business based upon our inability to assess value rationally. Or as H.L. Mencken once said, no one ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American public. The story of G. Spinney shows some of the effects of relativity, one of the most powerful forces that make us assess a value in ways that have little to do with the actual value. At G. Spinney, customers used to assess value based upon relative value, but relative to what? Relative to the original posted price. G. Spinney helped them make their comparison by posting the discount at a percentage and adding notes like sale and special to help them focus on the amazing relative price they offered. Which one would you buy? A shirt priced at $60, or the very same shirt priced at $100, but on sale? 40% off. Only $60. It shouldn't matter, right? A $60 shirt is a $60 shirt, no matter what the language and graphics are on the price tag. Supposedly, yes, but since relativity works on us at a very deep level, we don't see these two the same way. If we are regular customers, we would buy the on-sale shirt every time and be outraged by the mere presence of the straight-up $60 one. $60 is relatively cheap compared to $100, but remember opportunity costs. We should be comparing $60 to $0 or to all the other things we could buy with $60. But we don't. We use relative value to compare current price of an item to the amount it used to cost before the sale or was said to cost as a way to determine its value. This is how relativity confounds us. By eliminating the sales and savings, G. Spinney removed an element that helped their customers feel their decisions were the right ones. Just looking at a sale price next to a regular price gave them some indication that they were making a smart decision. But they weren't. It seems that discounts are a potion for stupidity. They simply dumb down our decision-making process. When an item is on sale, we act more quickly than if the product costs the same but is marked at a regular price. Basically, since it is so hard for us to assess the real value of things, when something is on sale, when we are presented with a relative valuation, we take the easy way and make our decision based upon the sale price. We compartmentalize. In our private lives, we allocate our money to categories or accounts. We generally set a budget for clothes and entertainment, rent and bills, investments and indulgences. We don't necessarily follow this budget, but we do set it. Much like companies, if we use all the money in one category, that's bad. We can't replenish, and if we do, we feel bad about it. On the other hand, if there's money left in a certain category, it's very easy to spend it. Maybe we don't go to the extreme of putting money in labeled envelopes, but we all use mental accounting, even if we're not aware of it. Our categorization of money affects how we treat it and how we use it, but we don't always have clear ways to categorize our money. Unlike a company, our lives aren't filled with office supplies and payrolls. We sort our money into different types of mental accounts with different rules, depending upon how we get it, how we spend it, and how it makes us feel. Did we get this money from a job or from a lottery ticket found on the sidewalk? Or is it from an inheritance, embezzlement, or a career as an online gamer? A curious finding about the way we categorize money is that people who feel guilty about how they got money will often donate part of it to charity. Let that sink in. How we spend money depends upon how we feel about the money. Do we feel bad when we get it because it arrived under negative circumstances? Do we feel it is free money because we got it as a gift? People are likely to spend their salary on respectable things like paying bills because it feels like serious money. On the other hand, money that feels like fun, like $300 million in casino winnings, is likely to be spent on fun things like more gambling. Our mental accounting department is kept in check only by lazy auditors who don't want to think too much, love the pleasure of spending, and are burdened by an inherent conflict of interest. We are our own auditors. We are the fox guarding our own financial hen-house. We avoid pain. The term "the pain of paying" was based on the feeling of displeasure and stress caused by spending. But more recently, studies using neuroimaging and MRIs have showed that paying indeed stimulates the same brain regions that are involved in processing physical pain. High prices stimulate those brain mechanisms with higher intensity. But it's not high prices that cause pain. Any price, though. There is a pain we all feel when we give up something. The pain of paying should get us to stop making painful spending decisions. But instead of ending the pain, We, with the help of financial services like credit cards, devise ways to lessen the pain. Using credit cards, e-wallets, and automatic bill pay is the equivalent to putting little financial helmets. Like bad doctors, we treat the symptom, the pain, but not the underlying disease, the pain. This is one of the big mistakes that influence the ways in which we evaluate our money decisions. The pain of paying is the result of two distinct factors. The first is the gap between the time when our money leaves our wallets and the time we consume the good for which we've paid. The second factor is the attention we give to the payment itself. The formula is pain of paying equal time plus attention. Credit where credit is due. This is one of the evil geniuses of credit cards. The main psychological force of credit cards is that they separate the time that we consume from the time we pay. Because credit cards allow us to pay for things in the future, they make our financial horizons less clear and our opportunity costs more blurry, and they lessen our current pain of paying. Credit cards capitalize on our desire to avoid the pain of paying, and that has given them the power to shift the way we perceive value. With easier, less salient payment and the shifting of time between payment and consumption, credit cards minimize the pain of paying we feel at the moment we buy something. They create a detachment that makes us more willing to spend. As Elizabeth Dunn and Mike Norton noted, this detachment is not just about how we feel in the moment. It also changes how we remember the purchasing experience in a way that makes it harder to remember how much we've spent. Not only are we more willing to pay when we use credit cards, but we also make larger purchases, and we're more likely to underestimate or forget how much we spent and make spending decisions more quickly. We trust ourselves. It turns out the person we trust most is ourselves. Our overtrust in ourselves is most pronounced and most dangerous when it comes to our first impressions, which is when we are likely to fall prey to anchoring. Anchoring occurs when we are drawn to a conclusion that should not have any relevance to our decisions. It is when we let irrelevant information pollute the decision-making process. Anchoring might not seem too worrisome if numbers don't pollute our decisions. But the second, more dangerous part of anchoring is that this initial, irrelevant starting point can become the basis for future decisions from that point forward. Overhurt. Hurting is the idea that we assume something is good or bad based upon other people's behavior. If other people like it, review it well, or beg to see it, do it, pay for it, we'll be convinced it's good. We assume something is of high value because others appear to value it highly. Hurting is essentially the psychology behind review site like Yelp. It's why we're drawn to restaurants and clubs with long lines outside. Self-hurting is the second, more dangerous part of anchoring. Self-hurting is the same fundamental idea as hurting, except that we base decisions not on those of other people, but on similar decisions we ourselves have made in the past. We assume something has a high value because we valued it highly before. Once we pay $4 for a latte or $50 for an oil change, we're more likely to do so in the future because we have made this decision before. We remember it, and we're partial to our decisions, even if it means paying more than we need to. This is how anchoring starts with a single decision, but then grows through self-hurting to become a bigger problem, creating a perpetual cycle of self-delusion, fallacy, and incorrect valuation. We purchase a widget at a certain price because of a suggested price, an anchor. Then that purchase price becomes evidence that this was a good decision, and it becomes the starting point for our future purchases of similar widgets. Another value-manipulating cue is confirmation bias. Confirmation bias pops its head up when we interpret new information in a way that confirms our own perceptions and expectations. Confirmation bias is also at work when we make new decisions in ways that confirm our previous decisions. When we've made a particular financial decision in the past, we tend to assume we made the best decision possible. We look for data that supports our opinion, feeling even better about the quality of our decision. As a consequence, our previous decisions are reinforced, and we simply follow suit in the present and future. Anchoring affects real estate pricing, salary negotiations, jury awards, and our tendency to buy more of the same product when we see a sign that tells us buy 12 and get one for free. We overvalue what we have. In an ideal, rational market, both sellers and buyers should come to the same valuation of an item. That value is a function of the utility and opportunity costs. In most real transactions, however, the owner of an item believes it to be worth more than the buyer. Investing in anything causes us to increase our sense of ownership. And ownership causes us to value things in ways that have little to do with their actual value. Ownership of an item, no matter how that ownership came to be, makes us overvalue it. Why? Because of something called the endowment effect. The basic conceit of the endowment effect is that the current owner of an item overvalues it, and because of that will want to sell it at a price higher than a future owner will be willing to pay for it. After all, the item's potential buyer is not its owner, and therefore is not affected by the same love what you have endowment effect. Typically, in experiments testing the endowment effect, Selling prices are found to be about twice as high as buying prices. The endowment effect is deeply connected to loss aversion. The principle of loss aversion, first proposed by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, holds that we value gains and losses differently. We feel the pain of losses more strongly than we do the same magnitude of pleasure. In other words, we feel the pain of losing $10 about twice as strongly as we do the pleasure of winning $10. Owners of an item value the potential loss of ownership much more than non-owners value the potential gain of the same item. This gap fueled by loss aversion gets us into all kinds of financial mistakes. The magic of language and rituals. Language enhances or reduces the quality of the consumption experience, and that's the primary reason it influences the way we value something, be it chocolate or a purebred hamburger. One important type of language that does so is called consumption vocabulary. Consumption vocabulary gets people to think, focus, and pay attention, to slow down and appreciate an experience differently. A one-minute description of a chef's specialty dish not only focuses on that dish for an entire minute, it also provides context and depth to the dish itself. It concentrates on the flavors and texture and taste, giving us a nuanced, complex way to think about the dish. We might imagine ourselves looking, crunching, smelling, or cutting. Our mind and body prepare for the experience. When language supports an experience or anticipation of an experience, it changes and enhances that experience and how we value it. Words seem fair. Terms like artisanal, handcrafted, fair trade, and organic are used not only to signify creativity, uniqueness, political views, and health, but also to signal extra effort. Effort terms tell us that a lot of labor resources went into a product and implicitly suggest that the product's value is higher than it would be otherwise. These words add value. We overvalue expectations. In a recent branding study, volunteers were asked to try out products, some of which carried fancy brand names and some of which didn't. Participants wound up truly believing that brand name sunglasses blocked out more glare than lesser-known ones and that brand name earmuffs canceled out more sound. In these experiments, all the products were the same. They were just branded differently. The label made a real impact on the perceived usefulness of each product. We might expect brand names just to improve expectations. But in fact, the expectations created by the brand names actually improved objective performance. When we examine real performance, we see the brand name product did block more light and silence more noise. Participants preached themselves into becoming true believers, converts to the Church of the Holy Brand. They expected brand name items to perform better, to be of greater value. And it was their very expectation of such increased value that made it so. It was a self-fulfilling sunglass and earmuff prophecy. We overemphasize money. Christopher H.S.E., George Lauenstein, Sally Blount, and Max H. Bazerman once ran an experiment in which they asked people browsing used textbooks how much they would pay for a music dictionary that had 10,000 words and was in perfect condition. Another group was asked how much they would pay for a music dictionary 20,000 words but a torn front cover. Neither group knew about the other dictionary. On average, the students were willing to pay $24 for the 10,000-word dictionary and $20 for the cover torn 20,000-word one. The cover, which was irrelevant to looking up words, made a big difference. The researchers then cornered another group with both options simultaneously. Now the students could compare the two options side by side. That changed their perception of the products. In this easy-to-compare group, the students said they would pay $19 for the 10,000-word dictionary and $27 for the 20,000-word one with the torn cover. Suddenly, with the introduction of a more clearly comparable aspect, number of words, the larger dictionary became more valuable, despite the torn cover. When evaluating only a single product, the study participants weren't sensitive to whether the dictionary had 10,000 or 20,000 words. Only when the attribute was easily comparable did it become an important factor in assessing value. Again, when we don't know how to evaluate items, we are affected by features that are easily comparable, even if those features have little to do with the real value of the product in question. In this case, the importance of the condition of the cover dropped. More often than not, though, the feature we overemphasize is the one thing that is easy to see and evaluate: price. Control yourself. When it comes to financial decision making, we can try all sorts of things to make our present and future selves behave more in line with our long-term self-interest. One solution is to use binding self-control, or what we call Ulysses' contract. Ulysses knew that if the sirens called to him, he would follow their voices to his and his sailors' doom, like so many sailors had done before him. He would not be able to control himself. However, he wanted to hear the sirens. Therefore, he asked his sailors to tie him to the mast of the boat. This way he could hear the call of the sirens but not act on his desire to follow them. A Ulysses contract is any arrangement by which we create barriers against future temptation. We give ourselves no choice. We eliminate free will. Unfortunately, Ulysses contracts rarely come with awesome music, but, on the other hand, They also rarely involve smashing our ship onto jagged rocks. Common financial Ulysses contracts include presenting limits on our credit cards, or only using prepaid debit cards, or even canceling all of those cards and only using cash. What should not matter in a perfectly rational world? Sales prices or savings, or how much we're spending at the same time on something else, relatively. The classification of our money, where it came from, and how we feel about it. The ease of payment, pain of paying, the first price we see or previous prices we've paid for purchase, anchoring, our sense of ownership, endowment effect and loss aversion, the ease of comparing the price of a product, experience, or widget, overemphasizing money, whether we give in to the temptations of the present, self-control. In the end, money really isn't the only thing that matters, but it does matter to all of us a lot. We spend an extraordinary amount of time thinking about it, often incorrectly. We could continue to let price setters, salespeople, and commercial interests take advantage of our psychology and behavior tendencies and foolishness. We can wait for societal or governmental interests to put programs in place to protect us from our own foolishness. Or we could become more aware of our limitations, design personal systems to correct ourselves, and take control of our financial decisions so that our precious, finite, and immeasurably valuable lives can grow richer every day. Whether you prefer to read or listen, we have something for you. Visit bestbookbriefings.com now for more summaries.